Hello, hello, and welcome to episode 4 of the Organic Grower Podcast, a podcast of the Organic Growers Alliance. I'm your host, James Butterworth. This is a podcast where we hear from growers from throughout the UK about their growing methods and the way they run their businesses. We have a fantastic episode for you today with Ian Tolhurst of Tolhurst Organics. But before we get to that, I just want to say if you are liking what you hear and want to hear more of it, please consider donating to our Patreon page. For just £2.50 a month, you can ensure that we continue making the show and make it accessible to all. Just visit patreon.com/theorganicgrowerpodcast to show your support. And as a special thank you, if you are one of the first 50 contributors, we will give you a shout out on the show. So this week, a big thank you to Diana Moores, Sylvie, Connie Hunter, and Sammy from Middle Ground Growers. I also would like to encourage you, if you are not a member already, to join the Organic Growers Alliance. Join today for just £35 a year and enjoy a host of fantastic benefits, including the printed journal The Organic Grower, delivered to your doorstep every quarter, free entry to webinars and discounts to events, access to thousands of online technical articles and videos, networking opportunities, support and representation, and monthly emails with all the latest sector news, resources, events, jobs, and opportunities for growers. What a bargain. Head to organicgrowersalliance.co.uk today and click join. Now, we could not make this podcast happen without the generous support of our show sponsors, including our podcast partner, Ubi.
Hi, I'm Kelly from Why Grow, a veg box and flower business in Herefordshire.
And I'm Seb, co-founder of Hampshire Market Garden.
And we're also two members of the team at Ubi. For small farms and food hubs looking to sell fresh food to local customers, Ubi is an online platform that increases sales, simplifies packing, and optimizes deliveries.
Join the growing community of hundreds of independent producers using Ubi to sell direct to local customers, including Tolhurst Organics, Organic Lee, and Middle Ground Growers, to name a few.
Visit ubi.com today and book a free demo to see how we can help you thrive. That's Ubi with four O's, OOOBY.com.
Mention the OGA podcast and we'll waive the £350 onboarding fee.
Ubi, putting small scale back at the heart of the food system.
I'm very happy to offer my own endorsement of Ubi. We've been using Ubi at my business Cotswold Market Garden since the beginning of 2023. It has made our lives as growers so much easier and made the experience for our customers so much better. They are continually improving the platform and they've got a great ethos, so check them out. Thanks also to our other show sponsors, Reag Tools, Vital Seeds and the Biodynamic Agricultural College. Back to today's episode. We have a wonderful conversation with Ian Tolhurst, aka Tolly of Tolhurst Organics. It is a long one, but there are so many gems in here that I couldn't possibly leave any of them out. The whole point of this podcast is to share knowledge among growers, so if it takes you a few bites of the apple to get to the end, then so be it, it will be worth it. We talk about many things Tolly is well known for, including wood chip and green manures, but I was also keen to get him talking about the other side of the coin, which is sales. We also discussed Tolly's longevity as an organic grower, nearing 50 years now, and his advice for new entrants. His perseverance shone through when he agreed to go ahead with the interview despite having a stinking cold. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. Let's get to it. Ian Tolhurst, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me, James.
Why don't we start with an overview of your operation? Where are you based? What sort of scale are you working at? And what sort of things are you growing?
Right, well, we're in the very southern tip of Oxfordshire. We're actually literally very close to the banks of the Thames. So we're looking across beyond the Thames into Berkshire. We have Reading about 6 miles away as a crow flies, and we have the city of Oxford 20 miles away north of us. We're on a bit of not terribly high quality land. It's very flinty, chalky, very shallow. It's grade 3B, and in fact one of our fields is grade 4. We're on just under 20 acres, so around 7.5 hectares. We are growing extensive range of vegetables and some fruits. So we grow pretty much almost every vegetable you can think of, really. There's over 100 different types of vegetables. And we do some fruits. We're pretty much famous for strawberries. In fact, we've been growing strawberries now for, this will be the 49th year coming up organically. We have some top fruit within our agroforestry system. So we have a very extensive cropping plan over three sites. We have two fields plus a wall garden. And within the wall garden, we have about 2,000, just under 2,000 square meters of polytunnel and propagation area. So it is very diverse, and pretty much everything we produce on the farm, we produce around between 100 and 140 tons a year. It varies a bit, mostly depending on the weather. Pretty much all of that is sold within a 10-mile radius, and what isn't sold within that 10-mile radius is sold within a 20-mile radius. So most of the production of the farm is sold really quite locally, and this is very important to the farm marketing system. We are stock-free organic. We have no livestock on the farm. We've never had livestock on this farm. We've been growing without any livestock inputs at all since we've been here. I've been on this site now since 1987, so 37 years, and previous to that I farmed in Cornwall for 11 years, and previous to that I was on a dairy farm for 4 years. So I've been in agriculture for exactly 50 years this year, so I've had quite a long-term agricultural career, if you like.
It's a long time to be farming in one site. I can't think there are too many particularly organic producers who have that sort of length of experience on one piece of land. How's your sort of relationship changed with the land over that time, and how is it different to when you first arrived?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. When I first arrived, I had no idea that I would still be here 35 years later. That's one thing I could safely say. I wasn't sure what was going to lie ahead, really, when I came here, other than just what I wanted to do. We moved from a farm in Cornwall that we owned, which we had to stop owning because the bank got in trouble with the bank. So we are tenant farmers here. We don't own any of this land, which in some ways can give you a slightly different relationship to your land. And I guess within the first sort of 10 years or so, I didn't really feel that permanent, because we were on a relatively short 5-year, well, it's a share farming agreement, actually. It wasn't until we started to get a longer-term farming agreement, a longer-term tenancy, that I felt more secure, and we started to invest more in the land. So for me, the fact that we don't own the land hasn't really made any difference now. It perhaps did initially, but not now, because I feel we have permanence. I don't need to own this land to feel as if, you know, we can care for it. And I think clearly the longer term tenancies are much more conducive to good land management. I think short-term tenancies are a big problem for farms, because people will never invest in their farm if they don't see it as a long-term future. So I think that has certainly helped us in developing the farm. It's led us to get on and do agroforestry, which is clearly a long-term investment, and also to put up buildings. We've put up a lot of buildings here. We've built a farm shop, we've built packing sheds, we've built staff accommodation. And all these things are very important in terms of running the farm, but also important in terms of giving us that long-term security of the farm. So I feel increasingly sort of wedded to the soil, if you like, to the point where the danger is you never leave the farm, because if you leave the farm, you know, your fear is it's all going to fall apart. Well, this is something which I've had to overcome over the years, because clearly you have to get away sometimes. It's impossible to get a day off on the farm, so I do have to distance myself completely. But yes, I feel very much a part of not just the farm, but the landscape. We're very lucky at Harbury in that we have, over many years, there has developed an accidental community, really. As a result of us being here, it's attracted other people, and it's shaped the policy of the whole estate in many ways, what we do. So we kind of feel quite central to the operations at Hardwick in general, and the vegetables are a really important vehicle to that aim, to that end, in that it involves a lot of people, both in terms of its production, but also in terms of its sales and its promotion. So, you know, our relationship with land is very holistic. You know, we look upon it as, we look upon the farm as a complete organism, and we are just a part of that organism, if you like, really, in terms of the people oriented, the human element of that farm is us and the people that work on the farm. So we do like to think of the farm as a complete whole. A whole with a W, not an H.
I think your farm must be perhaps the most documented organic veg farm in the country. Does that sound fair?
Yes, certainly, probably the most documented organic one, and possibly even one of the top documented farms in general, because we have attracted an enormous amount of interest from a wide circle of not just academics, but farmers, Joe Public, and we have encouraged that in many ways. I think it's an important part of the whole farm system. And yes, we have huge amounts of data, which I am now eternally grateful for. We can look back over almost four decades at information and see how things have changed. So we have a very clear picture of where the farm has come from and where it's going to. And this has been, for me, hugely encouraging, in that, you know, even after this long period of quite productive cropping, we have, you know, very, very good soil health and very good farm situations. So having this data, having this wide interest from the wider community has really helped to support the farm in many ways, actually. Yeah.
And there are lots of places where people can find out more about your methods. And you know, you've appeared on a number of other podcasts and you know, lots of webinars and publications and so on. And but perhaps if there's anyone not so familiar with your operation, could you just let us know, you know, what is your sort of general stock-free organic approach? How do you approach rotations? How do you approach biodiversity? How do you approach fertility?
Right, okay. Well, the stock-free organic thing came about initially really by default and not by design. I didn't wake up one day with a kind of a light bulb. In fact, there's been very few light bulb moments in the history of this farm. It's things that have just developed, for want of a better word, in organic sort of way. So when we came here, there was clearly no opportunity to use animal manure because my neighbouring farmer, being an organic farmer, wasn't going to sell it to me. The only other possibility was to use the local horse stables. And when I looked into that, I was really uncomfortable with what the horses were being fed and particularly the amount of pharmaceuticals and anthelmintics they were getting. So we kind of had to make do without, really, initially. And as a vegetarian as I was then, this kind of fitted some of my principles anyway, that we didn't want to have livestock on the farm. We didn't want it for financial reasons because it wasn't going to pay. We didn't want it for moral reasons either. We felt it was an unnecessary waste of land. So we developed a system which was largely based around green manures. And in order to make that work, we had to develop quite complex and quite diverse rotations, none of which anybody had had any experience of before. So we were really pushing the boundaries at that point. Looking back, I can see what we did was in some ways quite very unusual, but it didn't feel that to me particularly at the time. It kind of felt normal to build these rotations. So I somehow came up with what I still consider for us to be the perfect rotation. It hasn't changed. We have been running the same rotation now for 3.5 decades. It has stood the test of time. The rotation is built primarily around the need to build fertility, but also to preserve fertility. And when I say preserve fertility, what I'm really trying to explain is the idea that you stop losing fertility through natural wastage. And many, many farms are bringing in huge amounts of inputs from outside, putting it on their soil, and much of that nutrient is being lost or wasted through bad soil management and by bad cropping situations. So the idea that we could no longer bring in manure or bring in fertility from outside very much concentrated my mind on maintaining the fertility we had, which was very modest. We didn't really have much to start. So maintain that fertility and enhancing that fertility, and the rotation was really key to that. So we needed the rotation to build and maintain fertility in order to do the cropping we did. Luckily, it kind of worked out. I mean, it could have gone wrong. It could have led to, you know, difficult soil conditions. It could have led to declining fertility, but it didn't. And we managed without any external inputs at all for many, many years. In fact, for 25 years before we discovered the potential of wood chip. So up to that point, this is up to about 15 years ago, we had managed with no fertilizers at all, no animal inputs in terms of manure from outside, no animal byproducts in terms of fish blood and bone and fertilizers and things like that, and no animal grazing. So we had completely excluded livestock from the farm, and it was working. We were able to see gradual increase in soil health, gradual increase in cropping ability, gradual increase in biodiversity. All these things are quite slow, and knowing what I know now, I could have speeded the process up a lot more. But you know, we were treading relatively carefully. Regular soil analysis and soil inspections showed that things were going in the right direction. But I always felt there was something missing from this system. I wasn't sure what it was until we started to experiment with wood chip. And this was a complete game changer. I am, by trade, I'm a woodworker. I still do it sometimes for my own personal use mostly, but I do a lot of building on the farm as well. So I have consumed vast amounts of timber in the past. I've built houses, I've built boats, I've done a lot of work with wood. So I've always had a very close connection with wood in the same way I have a very close connection with soil. I never actually managed to marry the two together. They were always two completely separate parts of my life in a way. And it wasn't until we started using wood chip that I realised there was a huge connection missing from our farm. That was a connection to forest and woodland. Most agricultural soils in the UK were originally either completely or sparsely covered in woodland. This is what our natural woodland was about in the UK. Most of the land was covered in wood. That's all been taken away, and most of our soils are a long, long way away from that original woodland environment. They don't have the fungi, they don't have the species rich that you're getting in fungal rich situations in woodland. So we've completely depleted our soils, really, and agriculture has become completely divorced from woodland, and woodland has become completely divorced from agriculture. I mean, we have this specialization in the UK where we have, you know, all the grass in one place and all the cereals in another and all the horticulture somewhere else, and the woodland kind of fits in around the wasted edges, and there's no real relationship between these various agricultural components. So the idea that we would bring trees back into the farm became increasingly more important once we started to see the benefits of wood chip. And it started off relatively slowly. We started processing from a local tree surgeon his waste that he gets chipped, and then we started to get involved in the use of ram your chip wood, which was from our own sources. We were coppicing some hedgerows that we planted. We planted the only hedgerow in this parish for 150 years, which is a terrible thing to have to say, but nobody ever bothered to plant a hedge for 150 years until we turned up. So we were coppicing hedgerows. We were also coppicing a piece of woodland, which we established almost 25, 26 years ago, which was a piece of very wet, boggy land, which wasn't suitable for growing. And we established willow on there. It's been fantastically useful. In fact, I would say it's the most productive part of the farm in terms of A, firewood, which is what we planted for originally, and B, ramble chipwood, and C, biodiversity. I mean, it ticks so many boxes. It helps the local biodiversity, it helps to drain our field, it produces huge amounts of carbon. You know, it's so important as a part of a farm. It's quite small, it's just over half an acre. So the integration of wood into the system was a game changer. It has completely altered not just the biology of our site, but also how we feel about our site and how other people see our site. It was And Wittingley, it was something which suddenly attracted a lot of people to what we were doing. Whereas Stockfree up to that point had been, I think many people thought we were slightly mad and okay, it works for Tolly, but it's never going to work for anybody else, you know. And then suddenly, once we start bringing wood into the equation, the woodland and the trees that we've established here brought a fresh impetus of academic interest, and that has really helped the farm in many ways.
And so that half acre of woodland, is that all coppiced for wood chip? How's that managed?
Right, it's pretty much all willow. It's white willow, Salix alba. It's managed on a 7-year rotation. So we have 5 rows of trees. We cut one row every year, then we leave it for 2 years. So we're cutting it on a 7-year cycle. We get some pretty big timber out of it. I mean, we are getting timber up to sort of 6 to 8 inches diameter and you know, 20 meters long. It's incredibly productive, and I've been measuring how much in cubic meters we've been removing from this area, both in terms of ramual chipwood and also in terms of firewood, and it's been going up quite steadily for many years. It's now in 25 years, so it's getting hugely productive. It is, by all accounts, my most favourite part of the farm. It's where the biodiversity is at its greatest, and it has a real sense of longevity. We know that this will be here in 1,000 years' time if it's looked after properly.
And so, you know, half an acre, you're managing it on a 7-year cycle. How much material are you generating from that area?
Well, every year on average, it's still going up. But every year on average, we're getting, if we include about half of it goes to firewood, which is about 8 to 10 cubic meters, and half of it goes to ramual chip wood, which is roughly the same amount again. So we're getting around 15 cubic meters of material from this every year. That's actually quite a lot. We're applying ramual chip wood at very modest rates. We're putting on the equivalent of, I need to look at my sums actually, but it's only about 6 ton a year overall of the rotation. It actually gets applied for 2 years out of 7, so it goes on at a higher rate. But overall, it's about six ton. It's about 12 cubic meters per year over the whole area. So it's a very modest amount. I mean, 12 cubic meters is about 1 millimeter thick. So it's an incredibly small amount. It's been targeted in a way which benefits the soil particularly. We only ever put this material onto green manure crops. It never goes onto bare soil. Putting any degree of organic material onto bare soil, I think in many ways is extremely wasteful. A lot of it will end up somewhere else in terms of nutrients. The idea that people plaster huge amounts of organic material on soil in order to increase fertility, I think is not a great idea. I've seen many problems where this has become actually what I refer to as soil obesity, where you can overfeed soil. Soil obesity is a big problem with small-scale growers. They are putting far too much on them, more than they could ever possibly use. And this is wasteful of resources. And I think it's also not good for soil biology. It will seriously upset soil biology. So we're targeting very small amounts at very specific points within the rotation in order to really wake up the soil fungi, to develop the soil fungi. And what we managed to do, and it was something I felt was happening but couldn't really be sure, but I think modern science has come up with some of the answers, in that we have managed to unlock much of the fertility that was locked into our soil through the use of fungi, primarily fungi, but also bacteria, soil organisms in general. So although we took on what was a very poor, low fertility site, it was very low in P and K, it wasn't that high in organic matter, we've been able to unlock a lot of nutrients. In fact, I would say most of our nutrients have been unlocked. It's not what we're adding to the soil. We're adding very little in terms of P and K. There is some nitrogen, of course, from green manures, but P and K, we're not really adding anything hardly at all. And we are unlocking the elements in the soil and making it much more available to plants. And it's really the bacteria and the fungi, the soil organisms, that have done that. And that's a process which, in theory, could carry on forever. There's no sort of end limit to how much you can continue to unlock the soil's fertility, because we are basically processing probably rock within the soil. We are 40% stone on our land, 40% stone over 10 millimetres. It's an incredibly stony site. It's more half stone in actual fact. So it has a primarily low fertility bank. It also has a kind of low moisture retention ability as well. So we've seen all these areas improve dramatically since we've been using wood chip, and it's really down to kickstarting that fungal activity.
And for those who are interested in experimenting with remnant chip wood themselves, could you just sort of give a rundown of the key things? You know, what size, what sort of diameter wood do you need? When are you applying it, and how long do you have to sort of? You said you're only putting it down on green manures. I think that's right. How long before that land can go back into crop production?
Right. Okay. The most important thing is primarily it has to come from hardwoods. Softwoods are not suitable. They contain a lot of terpenes and resins. They're quite difficult to compost. So they don't work well in soil. Very small amounts can be used, but I generally prefer in terms of the ramule chip to leave it out completely. We do compost some softwoods, but that's within a composting system. So ramule chip wood is always from hardwood trees. It's from young growth, so it has to be, it's more about the age and the size, but the general size that's considered to be safe to use is anything less than 3 inches, 75 millimeters, because that is mostly young sapwood. Once you start moving into older trees, you have a huge area which is predominantly dead. It's heartwood. It doesn't contain much sugars or nutrients or proteins. What you want is the younger wood. So this is why we go for younger wood, which is why coppicing is so good. So, I mean, coppice material is the ultimate, really. This is the best material to source. So any species of tree is good. If it's a hardwood, it doesn't even have to be indigenous. It could be an introduced species. There are plenty of quite productive trees around. It needs to be done during the winter, so it needs to be chipped during the dormant period. You don't want to be chipping it during the summer, quite apart from the sort of the biological upset of cutting stuff in the summer. It's also much easier to chip in the winter when you don't have the leaves. You don't actually need the leaves are not important. So it's chipped quite finely. It's chipped down to about 10 or 20 millimeters. The smaller the chip, the better. We actually use a contractor. He comes for 1 or 2 days a year, brings a huge big machine. He does all the chainsawing, does the whole lot. We blow it straight into the back of a very large moving floor muck spreader, spread it direct onto green manures. This is done usually sort of late winter, early spring. I generally do this around March when the land starts to dry out. The access to land is primarily governed by how wet it is. We can't drive on it in the winter. Very often it's too wet. So it coincides with a dry period of weather. It goes on at very modest rates. As I say, we're applying per hectare, the initial application is around 50 cubic metres. And I find it's much safer to think in terms of cubic metres rather than tonnes. A lot of people still talk in tonnes, although they've never actually measured what they're doing. So cubic metres is a much easier measurement to make. So we generally reckon that 2.5 cubic metres of wood chip, ramule chip wood, is equivalent to around 1 ton when it's fresh. It goes on at around 50 cubic metres per hectare. That's 5 millimetres thick. And the following year, we do it again. It only goes on to green manure crops. It goes on to a long-term green manure lay. We have a 2.5, nearly 3 year lay within our 7 year rotation. So we have 5 cropping years of vegetables and 2 3/4 years of lay. And the reason we managed to get that in is we were undersowing the last crop in the rotation, which is squash. We undersow it with that lay. So we're a year ahead, really. So this really takes me back to the rotation and how we've managed to organize and design the rotation to allow this long-term fertility building to work, and it's to that we add the ramule chip wood. And the reason we do it really onto green manure is primarily because I'm really uncomfortable about adding any organic matter much to bare soil because of the wastage and the loss problem. But also because when we have a situation of green manure, we have a soil which is stable, it's healthy, it's becoming healthy, it's happy. We have an increasing earthworm population because as we go into the long-term lay, we build earthworms rapidly because they have been slightly depleted during the previous 5 years of cropping. So we have a very healthy soil. It's physically stable. We can drive on it without doing much damage. It contains a lot of legumes and a lot of other wildflowers. We actually incorporate wildflowers into this. So it's in a healthy situation. And it's at that point where we can be fairly assured that the ramule chipwood will be fully processed on the surface. It never gets turned in. The worst thing you could ever do would be to turn wood chip into soil that has to be on the surface. So there is no problem with locking up with nitrogen, which is most people have this, and rightly so, have this huge paranoia about locking up nitrogen, which is a potential risk. So we avoid that completely. It goes on the surface. And the final sort of processing of that wood chip is done by the soil life, by the microorganisms, by the earthworms, in a relatively slow and quite sort of almost calculated way over sort of a year or two. So when we go back into that lay with our first crop, which would be potatoes, all that wood chip has disappeared. In fact, we've noticed that since we've been adding this, because we've increased soil life, it's disappearing pretty rapidly. So we could probably go in within a few months and not have any concerns about locking up of nitrogen. It doesn't happen because we want to leave that lay in for the full 2.5 years in order to build fertility and earthworm populations. But because the amount we apply is relatively modest, even if we were to cultivate that in, the chances of nitrogen lockup would be pretty small. We have a lot of potential N in the soil from the legumes. We've got red clovers, we've got lucerne, and we've got a lot of very deep rooting plants and herbs within that rotation. So I wouldn't say there's a lot of free nitrogen floating around, but it's enough to process what we need within the feedstock, which is the wood chip and the ramule chip wood. We also compost waste wood chip. So this is wood chip from tree surgery locally. It's not coming very far. It's literally within a few miles of the farm. And that would be a whole range of mixed species. It could be anything. It could be all year round. So it contains some leaves. We add a little bit of vegetable waste as well from the packing. It's not much. It's less than 10% by volume, but it's a good way of getting rid of our waste. And that's composted for 12 months through a windrow system where we turn it every 3 to 4 months. And some of that material goes into propagation. So we use it for substrate production as well for plant raising. We take about 10 meters of that each year for plant raising. So we don't buy any material in at all for plant raising. We only use wood chip. And to that, we add nothing other than vermiculite. So it's a really useful resource for us. And again, that substrate for plant propagation is biologically very functional, whereas if you're using peat, it's biologically dysfunctional and contains very little biology, whereas we have the complete opposite effect. It has enough nutrient, plenty of nutrient to grow most things pretty well. The only thing we have had to add a little bit extra nutrient to is alliums, where we grow alliums sometimes in modules. We don't have enough N to keep it going for a long period of time, but everything else, it works absolutely fine. We've never had a failure. We've been using this material now for more than 20 years, and we've grown more than around 2 million plants in that time, and we've never had a failure yet. So we know it works.
What I was wondering, listening to you talking about the ramule chipwood, is do you think this would, does this only work because you have a 2-year lay? If you had people with sort of 1 year fertility building green manures, how would that work with ramule chipwood?
Yes, that's an interesting question. I have wondered about this quite a bit. It would still work. I think you would need to be perhaps a little bit more careful how you applied it. You would really, ideally want a full 12 months before you turn that ground into the next crop. But given that it may actually put on a relatively small, I still don't see a huge problem with potential N lockup. It's only when you start putting large amounts on, and there has been some work done on applying Ramler's chipwood in arable situations, direct onto bare soil. Some of the results are not that conclusive, but there was definitely some indication that there was no serious lockup of N if the amounts you put on were modest. It's only when you start putting large amounts on. We need to be quite clear here about the material we use. Ramier chipwood is fresh wood. If you have old, dead wood shavings from joinery or from horse bedding, this is completely unusable. You cannot use this for anything. It's impossible to deal with. So it has to be fresh green wood. This is really important. And if it is young wood, it does break down pretty rapidly. So even within a 12-month lay, and I would like to think that lay would be probably a bit longer than 12 months if you were establishing that in the autumn under a crop, it could be a year and a half or even longer. I mean, this is where designing the rotation is really important, to allow that maximum length of green manure, but you can still have some cropping within that. So we're what I refer to as relay cropping, green manures and crops together. So we have the best of both worlds. We have a green manure crop and we have a saleable vegetable crop as well, in order to extend that green manure period. So the idea that you would perhaps only have 12 months, I think is in most cases is pretty unlikely. It's going to always be longer than 12 months if you've got a really good rotation designed around your green manures.
Yeah. But if it was, you know, if it was only one full growing season where you had that lay down, you would have to establish it in the autumn to be able to apply the wood chip in the spring.
Definitely. I think this is really important. I mean, if you talk about a 1 year lay, I mean, for some people, this is, you know, you sow it in April and you get rid of it, you know, even in September or the following March. You know, in many cases, this is not long enough. Having that period of, I call it rejuvenation. I completely avoid the word rejuvenation. So it's rejuvenating the soil, allowing it to recover, because you have to accept, and we do acknowledge, there are periods of time within the rotation when we are doing some soil damage. This is inevitable on this scale. You know, we're not one acre, no dig. We are, you know, extensive field crops. So acknowledging that fact is important, and knowing how to repair the damage is important. And the lay is absolutely key to that. There is no substitute for roots in the ground. There is, doesn't matter how much organic material you put on, it would never have the same effect that roots in the ground have. They can never do the same thing. So roots in the ground are really important. And you need a minimum period to make that work. And one of my favourite green manure crops over the last few years has been chicory. You know, chicory is absolutely amazing. In fact, we've used it in tunnels for over winter period occasionally. And the results we've had after that have been quite staggering. Actually, I mean, way beyond anything I could have possibly hoped for in terms of increased soil health and better yields just by having that one deep rooting crop. So, you know, what the green manure contains is important. It's not just about having green manure, it's having the right species, using them in the right way and processing them in the right way as well.
I'm interested to hear more about that. So just using straight chicory as a green manure in the tunnels?
Yes, this is rather strange, and I think some people may be surprised, but our soil health in tunnels is not as good as it is in the field. We have much better soil health in the field, where we have pretty regular but modest tillage, compared with the tunnels, where we have some, in most cases, a no-dig system with very small amounts of tillage. We do not have anything like the soil health in tunnels that we have in the field, and we're measuring that primarily. There's several ways, but one of the easiest is through earthworm populations. We have a far, far greater earthworm population in the field, up to 15 million per hectare. This is 1,500 per square metre, not cubic metre, but per square metre of topsoil, whereas in the tunnels we may only have 100 or two in that area. So a much lower, in fact, we are below what I consider to be a healthy amount. The tunnels get compost occasionally. They get minimal tillage, or in some cases, none at all. But they are cropped much heavier. We're getting 2 to 3 crops a year. And we have had some sort of mild problems with soil compaction lower down. And the chicory has really opened that up. I think one of the problems in tunnels is it's a closed environment. It doesn't always get enough water, even though we have quite extensive irrigation systems. It does tend to get dry sometimes. This will damage soil health. And I think the fact it doesn't get natural rainfall is another problem. We have a build-up of nutrients. We have very high phosphate and potash levels, despite very little going in there. So it's a completely artificial alien environment, and it shows in respect of the reduced soil health that we have in tunnels. And this is common. I have seen this on many, many farms. It's a very similar situation. The chicory's made a big difference in terms of getting into the subsoil, breaking up the subsoil, and connecting the subsoil and the topsoil together. Many crops in the tunnels tend to be there for quite short periods of time. We don't get anything like the opportunities for green manuring, obviously, because there's a much more valuable space. We do have some green manuring in tunnels, but nothing like as much as we have in the fields. So it's a much more exploitive system. It relies much more on inputs, although we put very little in terms of nutrient. We have too much nutrient already, and we have reduced how much organic matter we put in primarily because I am concerned about problems of soil obesity.
The Organic Grower Podcast is sponsored by Reag Tools, the number one place for market gardening, food growing, and regenerative agriculture tools in the UK. We've seen tools like the Jang Seeder, Paper Pot Transplanter, and Tilther available across the world and been envious of growers with access to them. Well, now you can get your hands on all of these and more with quick delivery and a friendly team to help, who are all growers themselves using these tools on a daily basis. Make your growing more efficient, head over to reagtools.co.uk to find out more. So, Tolly, you've been growing for several decades, and I think it's fair to say you probably know what you're doing on the growing side of things. I think what's impressive for a lot of people is that you're also seemingly been able to sell it for that amount of time as well. Can you talk to us about how you approach the marketing and selling of the produce and how that's changed over the years?
Right, yeah, that's a really interesting question and quite a complex one to answer. It's changed a lot over the years, and without wanting to paint too bleak a picture, it has become more difficult. There's no question of that. When we first started, we've been Soil Association registered since 1976. It was relatively easy. There was almost no competition. In fact, we were the only growers at that time in Cornwall. We were the only certified vegetable growers in Cornwall at the time. So, you know, we had potentially quite a large market, even though it's incredibly tiny. It's become much more difficult lately for a variety of reasons. There's a proliferation of so-called different types of agroecological produce. We've got all sorts of words coming in, like regen and nature-friendly, and, you know, there's a whole kind of proliferation of different descriptions, and Joe Public is slightly confused about much of this, and maybe we could talk about this a bit more later on. But the marketing has become more difficult. We've always, or nearly always, concentrated on trying to market as locally as possible. When we first started in Cornwall back in the 70s, I set up the first ever Cornish organic growers cooperative, first ever growers cooperative. And we did that really to bring growers together, to give us a kind of a marketing power, if you like. And it did work pretty well for a year and a half until all sorts of problems crept in. And the history of co-ops in the UK, particularly organic ones, is dire. They just don't survive. We have a really bad attitude, I think, in this country about cooperative working. We just don't do it as well as many people on the continent. So co-ops don't seem to work. So we were back to marketing on ourselves again, and we concentrated very much on local, and that sort of worked, and that did keep working pretty well. And then when we moved up here, we were producing much more, so we had larger output. We needed to sell larger quantities. We hadn't developed a market when we first moved to Hardwick. We were doing around 2 to 3 tons of strawberries a year, which we did manage to sell locally, but we were also producing, you know, 20 tons of potatoes and 15 tons of cabbage, and this was much more difficult. So we were dealing with wholesalers, and back in the 80s, there were a lot of potential wholesalers popping up all over the place, or guy wholesalers, most of whom went bust, owing us and lots of other growers money. There was a really difficult time during that period when marketing was unsure, supermarkets were starting up, so some growers were trying to supply supermarkets and all the problems that they faced. And in the end, you know, the thing that really saved us was the BOTS scheme. And, you know, I think we have a lot to thank for Tim and Jan Dean, who really brought BOTS schemes out and made them popular, made them cool, made them sexy, and made them available to growers. And suddenly, for the first time in many years, we had a lot of control over our marketing. And the original concept of the BOTS scheme, which has now been hugely diluted, but the original concept of the BOTS scheme was a selection of vegetables from your farm, from your geography, from your climate, and it was up to the customer to make the best of that. And it worked really well. I mean, it was fantastic. I mean, we had a 10-year period on the farm when we were making good money. We were paying all our staff well. We were taking them out for dinner on a regular basis. We were investing in the business. We were scaling up. We were increasing our production, and everything was absolutely fantastic. And the box numbers kept going up and up and up. And that continued right up until pretty much, the noughties, you know, as we call it, you know, the year 2000 onwards, when things started to change, the economic collapse of, I think it was 2007, started a kind of a spiral downwards of interest from the consumer. It also started a period of time when what I call the organic honeymoon was over. Up to that point, everything about organic was considered great. All the media was talking about it. It was a great thing to be doing. The royal family were getting involved, and Prince Charles, bless him, did a huge amount of promotion for organic and really helped the cause. And it was all heading in the right direction. It was ticking all the boxes. And then from around sort of mid-2000 onwards, it started to change. And suddenly organic started to be criticised for various aspects in terms of production and being elitist and all the rest of it. And the market didn't grow. In fact, the market has not grown really at all since then. We are still pretty much at a static market. We have managed to survive by various means, and it is primarily because we have concentrated mostly on the local market. We put a lot of effort into that. I think the effort we put in is disproportionate. The effort that goes into marketing is almost disproportionate to the effort that goes into growing. The growing is relatively easy. The agronomic side of what we do is straightforward. It's, you know, we can almost predict it, whereas the market, we cannot. It's very unpredictable. It's very difficult. I would like to be able to put a much more positive spin on this, but I think I need to be realistic about it. The marketing for us is still the biggest challenge. We are just about managing to keep our numbers up in terms of box numbers and the farm shop. We opened up a farm shop 6 years ago as a need to really fill the losses or the gaps we had within our BOTS scheme. You know, BOTS schemes have been changed radically. They are dominated by just a few very large players now who have enormous capacity to market, but even they are finding this is very difficult. They themselves are now being outwitted, if you like, by other schemes which have got nothing to do with organic food at all, but, you know, recipe boxes and that type of thing, which is now, you know, we can see clearly advertised all over the place now. So we are continually having to keep moving forward in terms of marketing. We do a lot of promotion. We use all the various media channels we can. We do a lot of on-farm promotion. We have various food events. And it's all about really keeping our name, our brand going in the local community. And it does take continuous effort. It really does. And this is where it's really difficult if you're a one-man band trying to do all this. I don't know how the very small growers can deal with this. It's much more difficult when you're small clearly, the bigger you are, the easier this becomes. But even then, it still becomes quite a difficult job. So it's very much about really trying to engage in the public, keep the public interested, get the public on the farm. We've done a lot to get public on the farm, and that's another, almost another branch of the farm, if you like, bringing public and people onto the farm. But it has helped to maintain our numbers. We do sell everything we produce, pretty much. We get occasional gluts, but you know, that's kind of normal in this job. And when we do get gluts, we have a deal with Fair Share, who are fantastic. They'll take anything over and above what we can't market ourselves. They'll take it. It goes into soup kitchens and local charities, and for us, it's a fantastic feel-good factor. I would rather not have to give it away, but you know, it does mean to say it does get used. So marketing is still really, it's the Achilles heel of what we do. And the fact that it's organic, which used to be a really useful marketing tool, if you like, is much less so now. I mean, when you look at the overall UK organic market, and it depends which figures you look at, but you know, it's sort of the average figure we're talking about is around between 2-3% of all food in the UK sold is organic. It's incredibly small. It really is. Okay, it's worth a lot more than it was when we started. I think it's up 3 billion a year or something. It's still an incredibly small part of the total food market. So we are up against a lot of competition from other growers, not just organic ones. We don't see organic growers as being a competition at all, but there are other growers who are nothing like organic who tend to be competing for a very similar market to ours. So in a way, we've been fairly lucky that we have a fairly large population on our doorstep. And what I have realized over many years, it's not about how much money people have. In fact, some of our best customers are some of our least wealthy customers as well. The more affluent your local population, the less likely they are to subscribe to your ideals. That's the reality. It's a very unfortunate one. But a wealthy population has also huge access to opportunities and choice. And for them, often organic is not a part of that picture. They're quite happy just to buy anything. They don't care what they pay for, but they just want convenience and a feel-good factor. So organic is not a purveyor of the rich and elitist at all. It tends to be, I would say, more middle-earning income people than the very high wealthy end. The wealthiest customers are the most difficult ones to deal with. They really are. We've had, you know, we've had people not pay us who we know earn vast amounts of money and have every available opportunity to pay for what they consume and prefer not to. So, you know, it's not about wealth. It's not even about social class, I don't think. I think it's more about how people feel about you in the local community. And I think this is really important. I think we do have quite a bit of support from the local community, and it's because we have tried to make sure we are a part of that local community, it more than in just the food production sense, but also in other areas as well in relation to the farm.
I think what you said there in terms of struggling to offer the convenience and perhaps choice that customers can find elsewhere is certainly a challenge of box schemes. How different is that with your veg shed? You have a sort of self-serve farm stand veg shed on your property. How does that differ? Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's been a really interesting exercise. What it's shown us actually what people want to buy. I mean, what people would really like to buy would be, you know, calabrese or broccoli, as they call it, all year round. You know, this is what they want. Well, of course, that's not reality in our climate. If you want calabrese all year round, I mean, for 9 months a year, it's going to come from Spain. But most people don't understand that. So the veg shed, our self-service veg shed, has been really educational in what people want. And the thing I found most surprising is the amount of potatoes we sell. Now, most people would tell you that they don't eat potatoes and that, you know, they'd rather go for other things. But actually, it is still our biggest selling crop. Potatoes is still our main and best paid crop of all, actually, because it's very low labour input. You know, we sell around 20, 25 tons of potatoes a year, just locally. It's quite a large amount. It's not a huge amount per person, but it's still quite a large amount. And the things that people buy are still staple vegetables. It's potatoes, carrots, onions, beetroot, cabbages. That's it. Lettuce and tomatoes in the summer. All the other things, all the kind of what I call, for want of a better expression, fluffy green vegetables, they actually buy relatively small amounts. And much research has shown that much of those fluffy green vegetables end up in the bin. You know, the biggest thrower of any vegetable, apparently, is salad bags. People buy them because they look great, and then they eat little bits. I mean, you know, we do it ourselves sometimes. We have a salad pack, and, you know, we often don't get through it all. And there's two of us, three of us here, sometimes more. So, you know, it's taught us what people really do buy, and it is about staple vegetables. You know, what they're buying primarily is calories. This is what it boils down to. And I did a recent back of the fag packet calculation on how many calories our potato crop supplies in a year. I can't remember what the figure was, but it's several million, and it's staggering, you know, compared with leaf, beet or char, which hasn't got anything like the potential. You know, we need those things for our diet, of course, but at the end of the day, it is very much about staple vegetables. And this is still what people buy. This is still the main purchase of our customers. So we've kind of been able to modify our box scheme a bit in the light of what's happened in the veg shed. And we've been able to promote things like squash, which have been a fantastically good crop for us over many years. Most of our customers are more than willing to accept quite a large number of squash, and we do grow a lot. And that in itself has now become a staple vegetable, which we could not have imagined 40 or 50 years ago. We didn't even know about squash. So things have changed, but people's demands certainly have changed, and they would like, as I said, to have calabrese all year round, and this is not a practical reality. The fact that we only supply things like tomatoes for, it's about 5 months of the year, which is pretty good as we don't have any heat. Most of our customers, well, I say most, a lot of our customers have got used to that idea. They may well top up from supermarkets in the winter. A lot of them don't. We have some customers who are really dedicated to what we do and will only eat what we provide. But that's not the bulk of them. I think there's a degree of arrogance amongst growers, and we've been guilty of this in the past, in thinking that people are going to eat what we produce. That's not how it works. People have their own choices about things, and we have to try as best we can within the limitations of the climate and the soil and the geography of producing a wider range. And we've kind of gone full circle now. We've started to reduce the range of our product because we've got it. It's become so complicated in terms of multiple cropping of huge numbers of different types of vegetables. We've started to draw back a bit from that and reduce some of the very minor crops, which never ever made any money. We just did them because we felt it was important to offer that choice. We've decided actually that we're not going to offer that choice as much. We're going to be concentrating more on what people mostly buy. You know, we can see how many black radish they buy in a week. You know, it's about 10. whereas, you know, we can produce, you know, 10,000 very easily, you know, but we can't sell them. You know, they're not. So we have to be absolutely realistic about what people want. And it's not about, you know, it's not about unusual vegetables, unfortunately. People are still very conservative about what they eat, despite the fact that, you know, food has come a long way in the last 50 years. I mean, when I was brought up, there was no such thing as courgettes. There was no such thing as many things. There were no salad packs. You know, a lot of these vegetables did not exist, and they really didn't. And they've been added to our diet, if you like, and I'm very pleased they have, because they do bring a huge diversity, of course, but it's often at the expense of the environment. The big argument around plastic is that we need to pack a whole lot of stuff now in plastic because, you know, we never used to do salad packs. We used to have lettuces only, and salad packs need careful packaging, and that induces a use of a lot of plastic and unwantable materials. So, you know, we've added to the problem, if you like, in terms of the environmental problem of food production by adding to the variety of food which we have. So it's a very difficult balance an act. We feel we need to try and to a point to satisfy customers' demands and wishes for diversity, but also we have to work that within, you know, within the constraints of a viable, sensible and sustainable farming system. And that is much more difficult. And most people do not understand the nuances of that concept, unfortunately.
And have you learned anything else about customer behaviour or customer preferences?
One thing, they are nearly all very honest, which is great. The veg shed, which is selling around 40% of our production, goes for the veg shed. I mean, it can be, you know, whatever, £1,000 a week sometimes. The amount of losses due to pilfering is incredibly low. We have one or two incidents, but we managed to sort that out with some cameras. And, you know, that's been really encouraging. It's really interesting to see how people's habits are dictated by the weather. A rainy day is really bad for business. I don't know why they don't come and shop with us on a rainy day, but I think they still go to Waitrose. I'm not sure. I'm sure Waitrose could also give you an account of how the weather affects what they sell. We're not in the privileged positions they are of looking at forward weather and predicting what crops people are going to want to buy, you know, when the sun comes out in 3 days' time, because we don't have those crops available. The thing that sells the best, as I say, is potatoes. And the thing that sells even better than that is strawberries. Strawberries have made a huge difference to our hungry gap problem, where, you know, we were running out of money in May and June. The strawberries have brought something quite dynamic, although somewhat complicated, to that situation, that we do have a very highly stable crop at a time of year when we are struggling for money. So to try and get this kind of working throughout the whole year has been complex. The best time we have for selling vegetables is between the end of September and June, and then July, August is hopeless, particularly August, because so many people go away. It's like they stop eating. You ask any grower what August is like, unless you're in an area of tourism, which we're not. August is a terrible month. It's the best month for production and the worst month for sales. So we have tended to change our cropping program over the years, and this has got worse each year. Actually, each August seems to get slightly worse than one before, so we have changed that over the years to producing far less in terms of highly perishable products. So we've cut down on things like tomatoes and leafy green stuff in the summer. We've pretty much given up on salad packs in the middle of summer, A, because they're difficult when it's hot. We are in a pretty hot part of the country, and B, they're difficult because there are so few customers around. It's not just people go on holiday, it's also people who have got bits in their garden, they've got a couple of grow bags and they're growing tomatoes, and it always has a big effect on sales. And it's not just the food industry, all sectors of commerce find August very difficult. So we've had to change how we deal with the midsummer situation and concentrate more on winter production, which in many ways is easier. I mean, winter production, they are crops which are less liable to go off, things like cabbages, beetroot, carrots, onions, you know, they're all things we can either store for long periods of time, either in buildings or in the field, and pull them when we need them. I mean, we've got carrots from September right through to March. Fantastic, you know, whereas strawberries you have to pick and sell on the same day, whereas carrots you've got 6 months. So they are, again, it's back to staple crops, which are the staple of our business, if you like. I think maybe that's what I call staple crops, you know. They are still incredibly important, although many people tend to play down the importance they have in diet. They are really important in terms of feeding people. It is, as I say, it's really about calories, very much so.
Sorry to interrupt your episode. I hope you're enjoying the interview, and if you are, we would really appreciate your support. The Organic Grower podcast will always be free, but we need to be able to pay for the work that goes into making it. So if you value getting the lowdown from other organic growers, then please sign up to our Patreon page at patreon.com/theorganicgrowerpodcast. If you haven't used it before, Patreon is a platform where you can donate money to content creators. You can support the show for as little as £2.50 a month. And hey, if you want to chip in more, then we're not going to stop you. To keep the show running into the future, we need to get our monthly Patreon contributions up to £200. So if you find value here, then please, please help us to keep producing it. Now, back to the episode. It's interesting you're talking about staple crops there. There's been a huge influx of people that have come into the sector over the last sort of decade or so, many of which have been quite small scale and specialised in salads and leafy greens and those kind of things, which is exactly what I do in my business. But do you have any advice for people sort of starting out thinking that that's what they're going to grow and that's what they're going to profit from?
Well, I think certainly for most people that is what they're going to grow, and that is the most sensible thing to be growing on a small scale. You certainly don't want to be doing potatoes, carrots and onions if you've got 1 or 2 acres of no-dig raised beds. It's just not going to work. So you have to concentrate on those leaves, and you have to concentrate on specialisation of those. And I think the danger is I've seen quite a few of those who have gone into too many crops. Again, it's about diversity. We all love the idea of diversity, but diversity is incredibly difficult to manage in the real world. If you've got, 50 different crops all coming at the same time, how do you possibly get around to A, picking it, and B, selling it? So I think you have to be really quite rational about what you choose to grow. The difficulty is, and you mentioned the word profit, I'm horrified and deeply concerned that there are so many small-scale growers, including ourselves, who find profitability is a very difficult thing to achieve. It really is. This should never be the case. It should be that anybody who works really hard and produces something really good should be able to live from that process and not have to work outside the farm or expect a partner to prop it up or to not pay themselves hardly anything. And this is often the reality. I am really concerned that I can point my finger at very few truly profitable horticulture enterprises of any scale. And this isn't just about the 1-2 acre person, it's also about the 100 acre person. But if you look at any farm, there are very few farms in this country that actually make a real profit. If they didn't get single payment, as they have done until now, or some other top-up scheme, most of those farms actually would not exist in the real world. This is a huge concern to me, in that it's really difficult to give any really good positive justification for setting up a 1 or 2 acre garden and selling locally, in that you know that that person's going to have to work incredibly hard and be very highly skilled just to make a pretty meager living. And this is wrong. This should never be the case. I didn't come into this thinking that we would still be where we are now, which is not making much profit. We do cover our costs and we have survived many, many years, but we're not making a big profit, despite the fact we consider we're doing a pretty good job and we're feeding a lot of people, as many small growers are. I think this is a serious problem which most of the smaller scale UK organic or agroecological, for want of a better description, growers find themselves in. This should not be the case. They should be doing much better than they are. There is a problem that a lot of people coming in don't have experience. This is another issue which is hard to deal with. It takes many years to gain experience, and during that time you have to try and pay yourself and pay your way. This is very difficult in a growing situation to do that. Far better do it at somebody else's expense first and then set your farm up. So I am concerned about the fact that a lot of young people who come into this with fantastic ideals and really good intentions will find it really difficult to get going through lack of money, through lack of resources, through lack of knowledge, through lack of experience. And, we need to tackle this somehow. We need to train people. We need a system of training people. We need support for those people while they're trained. They can't expect to do it for nothing. We need to generate this next generation of young growers. I mean, it's fantastic that so many people want to be doing this. I'm really pleased, because 20 years ago there was a huge shortage of new entrants coming into growing, whereas now there's potentially a lot. We know that some of them won't survive. That's okay. You know, for some people, it's aspirational and not actual. That's okay. That's kind of normal. But we need to be doing much more. I'll say we. I think we're really talking about government support here to train people, to set up proper apprenticeships, to make things available. Land is not a problem. There's plenty of land available. There's a lack of infrastructure. And the other really serious problem is a lack of housing. And I think this is perhaps, it's not just in agriculture, this is a problem. This is a problem across the whole country. But, you know, the so-called cost of living crisis is not about cost. It's not about the price of food or price of energy. It's about the price of housing. If everybody was only paying half what they presently pay, they would have enough money to pay properly for food and to pay their energy costs and look after their families properly. And this is a, you know, another issue, not for us as growers to deal with. This is an issue for government to sort out. But we need to give young growers support. We need training facilities. We need places for them to go and learn. This is really important. We need people who can teach them. We have almost none of that. That doesn't exist. I set up a group 20 odd years ago, Thames Organic Growers. We represent about 20 growers in the Thames Valley area. And we saw this potential for lack of training as being a real problem in the future for organic growers. So about 10, 12 years ago, we set up the Organic Apprenticeship Scheme, which was fantastic. It was a two-year scheme. It included mentoring and academic training, as well as vocational training. And it relied very much on the goodwill of farms to take people in and train them. And that worked really well for a while until we kind of ran out of farms, because you know, most farms can only do it once because it's quite expensive. And then the Soil Association took it on and they kind of just ran it down, really. And it ceased to exist about 4 or 5 years ago, which is a real shame. So the only training scheme which was set up and was actually working quite well has kind of fizzled out. We don't have anything like that at all for young people. We really need that. As I say, access to land is not the problem. The main problem is access to skills and access to cheap housing. It has to be cheap. You can't expect people to be paying ridiculous amounts for rent when they're trying to grow vegetables.
I mean, what do you, when you mentioned resources as well, how important do you think it is to have a decent chunk of money to start up with?
Yes, I mean, this is another problem, of course. When we started, we didn't have any money, let alone a chunk. You know, it's taken us decades to build up our business in terms of equipment, all of which has had to come from the proceeds, most of which has come from the proceeds farm. I never inherited anything. I'm from a very working class background. I left school at 15 and that was the end of my education. So I didn't come from a privileged background at all. And I've had to work really hard for what we got. And there's plenty of people in a similar situation with no capital at all. It is really hard. You do need capital, there's no question of that, which is why so many young people do gravitate towards the 1-2 acre no dig situation, which is pretty comfortable to set up in terms of capital. You don't need tens of thousands. You can do it on a few grand if you're really careful and prepared to work hard. So that model is important. It needs to be encouraged. I have concerns about inputs in terms of huge amounts of compost, but that's another issue. When you get to the larger scale production, I mean, we're kind of between the two, really. We're too big to be small. We're too small to be big. But if we're talking about field scale cropping, to make any economic sense of that in terms of getting the right kit and the equipment to do it, you really need 50 acres minimum. Well, you're not going to buy 50 acres because that's going to cost you a million or two, you know. So you need to have a really good arrangement with a farmer, which is long term, and you need to have the equipment, which, you know, could easily come to £100,000 if you're going to specialise in certain crops. And we're down to this horrible aspect of the need to specialise. You know, if you're doing field scale crops, to do it sensibly and with any possibility of profitability, you really are only going to be growing 3 or 4 crops within a green manure lay system. And that is not terribly exciting. It's a bit boring. You're going to have to sell wholesale, and there's difficulties in that. So that scale is quite hard to manage, but that's the one which is seriously lacking. I mean, most of UK organic production tends to be done on very small scale. We don't have these larger staple crop growers. And it's a worrying fact that 80% of all organic carrots in the UK are grown by one grower in Lincolnshire, Norfolk area, with one growing company. It's not one farm, it's one growing company. They also grow 80% of conventional carrots. You know, this is not the sort of leader that I think many organic producers would be aspiring to. You know, who wants to be in that sort of system? I certainly wouldn't. So, you know, scale is quite a complex one to deal with. And clearly, the larger the scale you are, in general, the better the potential profitability is. And this is a real shame. It shouldn't be that way, but it is because of the need for, it's a horrible thing to have to say, but efficient use of labour. You know, our biggest expense on the farm is labour. If our labour bill goes beyond 40%, we're in a potentially bankrupt situation. We have to keep it below 40%. And it's a very fine juggling act to keep it there. And that includes personal labour. If anybody is spending and paying themselves anything and it gets to 40%, they're in a really difficult situation. Not many people understand this fact. But it is a fact of reality that if you go beyond that point, you are going to face some difficult financial decisions to make. So, you know, the better the use of labour, the more efficient your farm can become. And that does inevitably mean on a larger scale mechanisation. You have to mechanise. There's no way around that. And my experience of most of the younger aspiring growers, and I can kind of, in a way, understand, they are quite phobic about machinery. They do not want machinery on farms. They all drive around in cars, but you know, the idea of dealing with tractors and machinery is quite foreign to them. And there's a reason for that. You know, they are the third generation second generation that never had to fix their cars. You know, I was brought up, we had to if we wanted a car, we had to mend it. Simple as that. So we learned from our fathers, but that situation no longer exists. Very few people understand machinery. So that scale of agriculture is largely uncatered for by the new entrants into UK organic horticulture. And I think this is a shame. I think there is great potential there for people to get it right. And there are plenty of farm opportunities where this would fit in really well with a much larger farm, you know, 50, 100 acres of vegetables on a share farming basis or something of that type. I think the opportunities need to be made, but it is about capital. It is about access to housing space as well. So it's a complex picture, and this is why generally most growers tend to go for the smaller scale, and it's perfectly understandable why they do. And we just need somehow to make sure that they understand the economics and that they are prepared to make some compromises in order to make that a profitable business. And it does mean working very, very hard. We know that.
You talk about labour. I'm interested to know a bit more about your team. You know, how many people you got working, and given that you're 12 months, you produce for 12 months, you have people going year round. How do you manage the workflow to make the most out of people working there, but also make sure that they can keep working through the whole year?
Yes, we're all busy all year round. It never really slackens off. It's a slightly different pace in the winter. It's a bit more laid back in the winter, but we have a core team. We have three full-time employees plus myself. I work comfortably full-time, sometimes a lot more than full-time. I tend to not do so much in the winter, but I do very long hours in the summer sometimes, despite, you know, my age. I still do that, and I'm quite happy to for a short period of time. So it's three full-time workers plus myself and my wife Tamara. She does most of the admin and the media stuff and the events organizing, and she's sort of part-time. We're all year round. We don't stop. We don't have a break as such. Everybody gets their holiday allowance, of course. They work a full week. Apart from during the winter, we have about 3 months when it's a four-day week, and that's just going to come to an end quite soon. It usually starts about middle of November, goes through till sort of end of February, where they're on a four-day week. And that's with their agreement. They're quite happy with that. It kind of works in quite well with us. It saves us a little bit of money. They're all very dedicated. We have one person who has been with us now for, we're not sure, but it's more than 25 years. And the other two have been with us for more than 4 years and are pretty permanent. I mean, that's the core team. We also have a driver who's a contract driver who comes to do one of our delivery rounds. We have two delivery rounds. He does one of those. He gets paid on a kind of self-employed basis. And then we have somebody who helps with the accounts and someone who helps with marketing. And we have lots of people doing just a few hours here and there, some of whom get paid in vegetables. So we've got, it's not just the core team. There are other people involved in this as well. And then we have, during the summer, we have a training opportunity. So we have usually two young people. Well, not always so young, but you know, we try to keep two fairly young people if we can. They come for 12 weeks. It's a training opportunity. They learn and work alongside of the rest of us, all of us at different times. They get paid a stipend where we look after them. We don't call them volunteers, although they are volunteering. It's an exchange in terms of skills, information, knowledge between all of us. They'll come for 12 weeks. There's usually two. And then we have another two in the autumn. We have two in the spring, two in the autumn. They're really useful. They're not. We try really hard not to use them as weeding machines, which I think is often the case on many farms. They become weeding machines. We have a pretty good system of weed control, which doesn't involve very much hand work. We've had to because of the cost of doing it. So, you know, they're not weeders. They get a good range of jobs during their time here. They get most things apart from, unless they've had experience, we don't let people on machinery because that is potentially hugely dangerous and potentially do a lot of damage to machines and crops. So we tend not to put them on machines, but they are helping out in general with all things. And they will be given areas of responsibility. They will be given access to all the information we have on the farm. They can also join into any seminars we have. We have fairly regular events on the farm walks pretty much every week. They come on to anything that's going in that sense in order to broaden their educational experience, if you like. And at the end of 3 months, they go away with an understanding of what it takes to run a small, very busy organic vegetable farm. Some of them will drop out after 3 months and realize that maybe this is not for them. That's fine. That's not a problem. We're quite, you know, okay with that. Some, and increasingly so more, go on to do other things. We've got people sort of camped out in different parts of the world now who have taken some of our technical knowledge with them and are doing amazing things. And this is what we like. We really like when people go on and take it further. So really, it's an initiation into what they could be doing here. And it's about acting as inspiration as much as anything. We've had some incredibly good people, both technically competent and socially competent. They all bring something with them, of course, and they take something away. And that's how it works. It's a mutual exchange between both parties. We are deeply indebted to these mostly young people who come along and help us. They are great fun. We try to get a balance of gender, which is pretty easy. It's not difficult to get that gender balance in organic vegetable growing. And we also try to get a balance of different nationalities, different backgrounds, and you know, we have people from so many different countries. It's been hugely uplifting for everybody on the farm for this to happen. So we're very keen to continue with that. We don't see this at all as being exploitation of cheap labour. It's not that. I mean, there's a big discussion going around about exploitation of labour on farms, of course, and rightly so. We see this as a really valuable contribution to what we do and also to young people's lives in general.
And having such a complex system there, you know, with several people working at a time, how do you go about sort of organising your week?
Yeah, this is the question I'm probably pretty hopeless at answering. In a way, it sort of organises itself. I mean, I'm trying to be less hands-on organisationally than I was, given my age. You know, I'm not going to go on forever. So it's really about people organising their own self. I mean, we have a kind of a pretty regular routine, which is around harvesting for the veg shed, that's our shop, harvesting for the bot scheme. You know, the harvesting is 4 days, 5 days a week now. You know, this is the thing, it happens every day. So we've already got that set up. So that has to be done. Everybody seems to know their job. I tend to take control of the larger scale field stuff. And I pretty much let the gardens go to, well, we have a lead grower, Sparrow, he's a lead grower. He kind of organizes that. He's been doing the cropping plans there recently. He's done the seed order. He's getting more administrative responsibilities as time goes on. So he kind of looks after the garden and draws up a big list, and there's a big board in the shed with all the jobs that need doing, which people love. People love crossing off jobs, you know. I mean, having a list is absolutely essential. I used to try myself to run the farm on list, but I got frustrated because I never got to the end of the list, you know. They don't mind not getting to the end. It doesn't bother them. So that works really well. And the marketing, well, Tamara kind of looks after most of the marketing in terms of the bot scheme and running of the bot scheme. We've gone over to Ubi. Ubi's been great for us in terms of managing the bot scheme. It's taken a lot of the effort that Lynn, my former wife, and I used to put into it. It's become much easier to manage now. So the farm, the day-to-day, certainly in the winter, I barely need to be around, actually. I mean, I haven't actually done that much farming for the last 3 months. I've been out occasionally on the tractor and done a few things, but, you know, there's not much to do in the field this time of year other than harvesting, and I've pretty much given up doing most of that. It's just done by staff, and I am always, in a way, I'm really heartened at how much they enjoy it. And, you know, and their enthusiasm. I think this is so important that people really enthused about what they do. You know, they're out there in the cold and the wet, and I can hear them laughing and chatting and enjoying doing the job. And this is really important, to have people that really enjoy what they do. And I think having that atmosphere around the farm of feeling like they're really having an impact, a contribution to life and society is really important. And I know they all really honour what they do. They really enjoy what they do. They really feel as if, you know, what they do is an important job. And I think that's, you know, that's one of the factors of a successful farm. I mean, you have to really enjoy what you do. We don't do it for the money. You know, they're on slightly better than basic minimum pay, but not much. And it's not about the money. It's about the feel-good factor. And the fact that the farm is, we're not just a farm producing vegetables, we go beyond that. We produce other things as well. We produce knowledge, we produce experimentation, we produce communications, you know, we produce integration to local community, you know, we produce a lot of things beyond just the food aspect. I think this is quite important as well for people working on the farm. So the farm day pretty much runs itself. I mean, I do butt in during the summer, you know. And I'm trying to do less in terms of the big jobs in the field, getting the big planting operations done and the big, well, we don't have big weed control anymore because it's mostly mechanical, but, you know, the big harvesting jobs, I will kind of set a pace sometimes and then sort of lead them to it, and they carry on. Well, you know, I've done my apprenticeship in harvesting squash, you know. I don't need to be doing that any longer to feel great about things, you know. But I'm really happy to see other people enjoying it and to hear the laughter and the chat that goes around the field. I mean, we are so lucky to have people that really love what they do and really appreciate what they do and do work very hard for what I consider to be a pretty poor wage, actually. So I think, you know, many farms run on similar lines. I think this is not, I don't think our farm is unique in this way. Having longevity, having somebody who's been working for us for 25 years is an enormous benefit. It really is. To have that really stable longevity, and that person will often take students and trainees under their wing and will show them things and kind of look after them. And we do have a very strong community here on the farm. I think that is critical. I could not think of anything worse for me. It may work for some people, but I cannot think anything worse for me than being on my own in a field working, harvesting vegetables all day, every day, all week. You know, not to have that human element, I think would be quite damaging to health in many ways. And I think this is a problem for some growers, in that they may often be on their own for too long. It can be a very solitary experience. I think it should not be. I think a farm has to be embracing of people, of its environment, of its own local society. I think this is a really important thing. A farm is not an organism on its own. It is part of a much bigger thing. And I think, you know, the people, really, for us, I don't think I'd still be doing this if it weren't for the people that we have around us. I think I would have given up by now.
Well, that's a nice thought. I can't let you go, Tolly. You talk about your longevity, and you know, you've done your time, and that's been recognised recently. You were awarded an MBE. How do you feel about that?
That's embarrassing, in a way. Well, it was such a shock. I could not possibly imagine such a thing. As I think I said, I left school with no qualifications at all, so I have nothing. So to get that was, for me, it was a big lift, a big boost. It was a recognition of what I've done over many years, but also it was a huge recognition of all the people that have been with me over this time. And some people may have only met for an hour or two, but they've all been a part of this award, really. And they've all contributed to me being able to achieve something which was considered to be worth an award. So, you know, our staff were just bowled over by this. I mean, none of us are kind of very much established people, and I have been sort of, I suppose in the past I have bordered on being quite anti-establishment in many ways, but you know, this was a significant award which we all benefited and really enjoyed very much. And you know, just local people I'd never even met coming up to me and say, oh, fantastic, who people I didn't even know that knew me, you know. So it's been a great feel-good factor which has trickled down through the whole of the local community, and that makes me feel good about that. But you know, it wasn't just me, it was about that whole community of people I've been involved with over such a long period of time. And the fact that King Charles has been a huge supporter of organic farming over many years and still continues to support it, although he doesn't actually get to do any work anymore. And, you know, I met him again recently and we had a bit of a chat about it, and it was great. So from being a very anti-establishment person, I have, I suppose, in a way become slightly more establishment, in that I've been able to receive that award. There's no way I would consider not taking it on, because I think it was a great acknowledgement of what I did, and hugely unexpected. I had no idea this was going to happen.
Well, congratulations for that.
Thank you.
We are at the end of the interview, pretty much. A couple of bonus questions for you. I'm calling this mistakes and easy wins. What mistake have you made in the last year that you've learned from and might help others?
Mistake.
There must be one, Tolly. There must be one.
There's loads. You know? I'm trying to think of the last year. I might have to really go back through my brain. If I can go back more than a year to a few years, well, during the COVID situation, was taking my eye off the ball. I mean, complacency is a dangerous thing. With growing, you have to be there all the time. You have to be keeping an eye on what's going on quite closely. And what happened during COVID was quite remarkable. And suddenly we had a vast potential market that we'd never had before. And we were having people fall over themselves to get to our produce. And luckily at the time, it was not a great time of year. It was sort of coming up to Hungry Gap. We still had quite a bit of produce left, so we were selling huge amounts of stuff really easily, and we'd never seen it so good. And during COVID, we took on extra customers, we took on extra staff to deal with it, and it was looking fantastic. And, you know, the bank account was filling up with money in a way that we'd never seen before, and it was looking really great. So at that point, I stopped worrying about, you know, where's the next £1,000 going to come from, because it kind of looked like it sorted itself out. And this went on for quite a while. And at one point, we were even thinking, well, what are we going to spend all this money on? We need to get rid of it, or we're going to end up paying tax. And I've always had a real policy about not paying income tax much and reinvesting it in the business. So we started thinking of ways to reinvest. And there was a hint of caution in the back of my mind, hang on a minute, maybe we shouldn't do this just in case something goes wrong. Well, it did go wrong. I mean, what happened was COVID ended. All our customers that we thought we'd gained, and we knew most would go, but we didn't expect them all to go, all just evaporated again. And we were back to our normal numbers, but we had too many people working here. And suddenly this vast accumulation of wealth, which, well, felt like a vast accumulation of wealth in our bank account, kind of got flitted away on paying wages, which we should not have been paying. So we got into a really very close financial shave, and it's not the first time we've been there. We've experienced this quite a few times in our history, but this was particularly acute. And we had to work really hard to get out of that and to recover our financial status, which took the best part of 12 months. So the moral of the story is, don't take your eye off the ball. You need to be checking things on a very regular basis. And my mistake was I stopped looking at the bank account because it just looked too good, and I just gave up on it. That was a big mistake. There's been other technical mistakes as well. Generally speaking, technical mistakes don't happen very often now because I've kind of done them all before. And I, you know, you're pretty stupid if you make the same mistake twice. I'm just trying to think of a really bad technical mistake that happened this year. Well, it's a simple one. It's like crop covers. I mean, it sounds a bit mundane, really, but, and I know this, I should know better at my age. Crop covers, we leave crop covers lying around in the field in odd corners, usually under a hedge where they don't get too much sun on, which helps keep. We don't have a great system of storing them. They're too big. It takes 3 or 4 people to move them. So we bund them on the hedge. Now, we know that when we pull them out, they're full of slugs, it always. So what we have a policy of laying them out in the sun for a day, let the slugs die off or move, and then turn them over and do the other side. We didn't do it last year, so we dragged a whole lot of slug-infested crop covers over, I think it was 1,000 or 2 brassicas, and consequently, the whole lot got munched because the slug population was there. It's such a simple thing, which takes a little bit of work. I mean, it takes, you know, 2 or 3 people half an hour each time to turn the cover and to move it. You know, we're talking about a cost of maybe, you know, 30-40 quid in labor. Well, the cost in terms of lost cabbage, you know, was several £1,000. So a tiny little thing like that, it's that attention to detail, which I think is really important. And it can be really hard sometimes. I'm trying to think why that didn't happen. It was because I didn't remind somebody, or somebody else hadn't thought. I mean, I ultimately, anything goes wrong, I have to really take responsibility, because I am still the overall farm manager. So if anything goes wrong, it's not going to be blaming somebody who didn't think about it. It's really me that should have reminded that person to have done that. And when you're running what is a very busy operation, not just farming, but, you know, other operations as well on the farm, such things can get forgotten about, and they can take a lower priority. And it's this attention to detail which is so important in any growing situation, not just organic, but any growing situation, which you need to be really on the ball to make sure that these jobs are getting done properly. And the one piece of advice I would give to anybody is always have a walk around your farm at least once a week and look at everything, see what's going on, because often you can miss something and that can be quite expensive in different ways. So yes, it's that continual need for quite detailed attention in order to keep the farm running efficiently. It doesn't take much to tip the balance between being marginally profitable to not profitable. You know, the balance, it's a bit of a knife edge. You know, you have to make sure that you don't have big crop failures, and we're pretty much We rarely get large crop failures. We get odd little bits now and again, but we don't have large crop failures as we used to many years ago, and they can be quite demoralizing in a way. I think I've got past the point of worrying about such things even, because they rarely happen. If they do, I kind of put it down to nature, and that's okay. That's, you know, we'll survive. We're not going to die, you know, as a result of that. So it's that, yeah, attention to detail is really important. I could probably go through more than one thing in the last 12 months that we've done wrong, but that's one reasonably good example.
So those are your mistakes. How about easy wins, Tolly? Quick things or simple things to do that have a big impact?
Simple things to do that have a big impact. These are quite difficult questions, aren't they?
It's the last one. Don't worry.
I should be able to answer this quite easily. Simple things to do that have a big impact. I think delegation. You know, I've had to deal with letting go of things, given where I am in my life, and a couple of years ago, we decided that our strawberry operations run as a separate unit almost within the farm. You know, we have separate people come and look after it. And I decided it was something which I needed someone else to manage, basically. So we have a person who comes just for strawberries every year, Alice, Strawberry Alice, she's called. And she takes that job over. She looks after the strawberries right from, you know, the first pick right through to the last pick, the whole harvest, basically. And looks after the team. Now, we have about 7,000 or 8,000 plants. It's not big, but it produces a lot. We produce around 2,000 kilos each year. So it's quite a lot of picking. So she looks after that. And it's such a relief not to have to worry about it. I mean, I can basically more or less almost forget about strawberries. You know, the marketing is simple. They sell themselves, and the picking gets done by Alice and her team, who do a fantastically good job. And they just go out whatever time they need to, and they pick the job and they get paid whatever hours they do. It works beautifully well. So being able to delegate certain things, which always in the back of your mind, you're kind of slightly worried that people won't do it as good as you, but that's often not the case. In many ways, they can do it better than you, and relieve you of some of that pressure. I can go and deal with something else, like another piece of broken machinery, which is also quite an important part of my job, looking after all the kit.
Well, Tolly, thank you so much for your time today, for being so open and sharing your insights based on many years of experience, which is, like I say, recognised by the fact that you got the MBE last year. So congratulations again on that. And thank you. Happy growing for 2024.
Yeah, well, that's the great thing about this. You know, we've got to spring, and I've just done the seed oil, and I'm still feeling enthusiastic about the next year. And, you know, we're getting close to 50 years. So I think that many growers experience this. You know, I know many growers find there are times when it can be really difficult, particularly, you know, during the winter sometimes. But provided you can still look forward in the spring, I think that's when you realise you have to keep going, really. It's an important time. I'm really happy to do it. It feels a bit like Desert Island Discs, really, this. Do you know Desert Island Discs? I don't know if anybody old enough to know Desert Island Discs. But this feels a little bit like Desert Island Discs. You know, I can take my book and a bit of music with me off to my desert island. And thank you for organising this.
No, not at all. Thank you, Tolly.
My pleasure.
Well, there you go. That was Ian Tolhurst of Tolhurst Organics. Thanks again to Ian for his openness and wisdom. And remember, if you value the work we do in making the show, then please sign up as a supporter on our Patreon page at patreon.com/theorganicgrowerpodcast. Before I go, I want to say a big thank you to our show sponsors, without whom we could not make this happen. So a massive thank you to Ubi, Reag Tools, Vital Seeds, and the Biodynamic Agricultural College. We'll be back next time with another inspiring grower, and in the meantime, happy growing.